In this episode of Pemba On Demand, we are releasing the live stream from March 18th, 2025. Our guest is Dr. Archie Bella. Dr. Bella is an internist by training. Archie is currently the CEO of a federally qualified health center in California. He attended Pemba to obtain his MBA at a point in his career when he had quite different plans. Welcome to Pemba On Demand, physician leaders making a difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. The views and opinions expressed by me, the host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization we are affiliated with. I'm pleased to have Dr. Archie Bella as my guest on the show. Archie is a fellow Pemba alumni, graduating from the class in 2020. Dr. Bella trained in internal medicine, and he has a great story to share with us today. I'm really excited to have him on the show. Our topic today is From Clinic to C-Suite, A Physician Leader's Evolution. Archie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everyone. Good afternoon, Norman, Dawn, and all Pemba listeners.
Great. Well, we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. You're currently the CEO of a federally qualified health center in San Diego, California. Many of our listeners may not be familiar with federally qualified health centers. I wondered if you could take a few moments to just explain what FQHCs are.
A federally qualified facility or community health center, it's what we call safety net providers, right? It caters to a lot of the underserved and unserved, mostly, you know, Medicaid population. And, you know, these are community health centers that get support from federal government through grant funding or through competitive state grant funding that is unique to it. And it has a lot of differences, you know, when it comes to non-federally qualified facilities, but mostly surrounding that, you know, the grant funding, the way things are reimbursed and other programs that it's unique to that particular industry.
What is the main difference between the reimbursement model for an FQHC and, say, a physician who's in private practice?
Good question. This is always one of those surprises. Now, when a physician that doesn't come from a federally qualified facility, then they join a community health center, they always think of, you know, I put a code, bill that, get paid for that, right? But in a community health center, we are paid through what we call a PPS, prospective payment system, PPS rate, sort of like a global rate, right? It doesn't matter what code you put there, whether it's an 03, 04, 05, 13, 14, 15. No matter how many codes you put there, you are paid that sort of global rate, what we call the PPS rate, for every visit. So that's the main difference when you compare it to non-FQHCs.
So how did you decide to practice medicine in an FQHC? What led to your decision to begin practicing in this environment?
You graduated, I completed internal medicine residency, so I never really thought I'd be practicing in an outpatient setting, right? You know, during the IM residency, either you go to fellowship or you finish, and then most of us go to what we call the hospitalist program. So I was a hospitalist for a good 3 years. And then at that time, I told myself jokingly, God, I can't see myself running around the hospital when I'm in my 60s. Now, there are several things, you know, as a hospitalist that I didn't really truly enjoy. For example, 7 day on, 7 day off, right? You have that 7 day off, but then your friends are all working, your family, your relatives are all working. Half of that week, you're just sort of recovering, from the prior week work. So, and then the satisfaction of, not having to manage chronic disease. Obviously, hospital is always different, right? And then a lot of your patients in the hospital, I felt like at that time, they don't know who I am. I'm the one taking care of them, but, you know, they they don't really truly know who I am. So I said, I think I would enjoy more doing outpatient practice. I think the satisfaction will come from, as an internist, you know, in doing outpatient practice. I transitioned to outpatient from hospitalist. And then I was in Bakersfield at that time where my family is. And we have a family friend. He's an OBGYN that introduced me. Why don't you join us here at, you know, this center? You know, we're an FK. At that time, it's an FKHC lookalike. At that time, I really know what the difference is, right? It's like, okay, let me try it. And the rest is history.
So did you work in a private practice in an ambulatory setting before you joined the lookalike?
No, the FKHC lookalike. While doing the FKHC lookalike, I opened, I opened a private practice as well. So half of the time I was in the FKHC lookalike, half of the time I'm doing private practice.
Okay. So I'd be interested in hearing the story of how you went from a staff physician in an FQHC lookalike to the CEO of an FQHC. Just tell me a little bit about that, because I thought that was fascinating when we talked.
I was doing my private practice. I was in FQHC lookalike. I was in Bakersfield. At the time, I said, it's purely logistics for me. Now, at that time, I was like, I think I would enjoy more if I live in Southern California. It's more geographic for me at that time. It's like, so I moved to Southern California. At that time, I moved to Palm Springs. And I joined a big practice there. And then I was enjoying my practice. I was there 3 years. And then that's when I did my MBA. And then, you know, physicians, we all get these notifications like, job from job recruiters and things like that. And then one of those notifications, I usually ignore them, but there's this one notification that says Operation Samaha. Now, at that time, they were looking for a chief medical officer. And my interest there is that Operation Samaha is a Filipino word. So it got me curious, Googled the history of Operation Samaha. It's a federally qualified facility that's been around for about 50 years that was Filipino founded. And I said, well, what better way? No, but to circle back and actually serve the population, the Filipino population, right? So it's a huge decision for me because that means settling again, moving from Palm Springs to San Diego. I was really happy with my practice in Palm Springs. Went through the interview and here I am.
And did you start as the CMO in
that
role?
Yes, I did.
Okay. How long were you in the CMO role before you were promoted into the CEO role? If I can call the CEO move, I know there's good and bad about every position. But how long before you made that transition?
Once I was CMO 6 months and then moved into the CEO role on my 7th month.
Okay. So you didn't have very long to get to know the organization before you were elevated into the CEO position.
Not very long, but I would say in that 6 months, I got to know it very well.
So what have been some of the biggest challenges that you faced since taking over as the CEO?
So at the time, first of all, the organization, there's a lot of operational gaps. The organization was in the red. Let me put it that way. We're losing a lot of patients. Clinic visits were down. I would say at that time, you know, had it not for the pandemic, I was telling my staff, it was like a blessing in disguise. Otherwise, with the trajectory at that time of the organization, it would have been non-surviving already, let's put it that way. And there's a lot of challenges from workforce to operations to IT infrastructure that needs to be taken care of. And so those are the main challenges, really. Sustainability, it's survivability at that time really was very questionable.
So what types of things have you had to implement in order to overcome those challenges? And have you managed to put the organization on a more stable footing since you began this role?
So this is where my MBA learning actually helped me quite a lot, really. And it started with the Baldrige. It started with the Baldrige. And, you know, truly, if there's really one thing that I really took into heart, you know, during the MBA, apart from, you know, the reading financial statements, things like that, you know, the Baldrige framework. I need the self-assessment, you know, for an organization. It really helped me. I started there. And in fact, I reached out to Don. I don't know if Don remembers. I did reach out to him and ask for his thoughts. And then I even had him do a Zoom meeting with the executive team at that time to discuss what Baldrige is. Because I truly believe that having a framework, you know, that allows us to assess an organization in a holistic level, right? From operations, workforce, to IT, to financial, and put them all together, you know, with all the executives there, where to, you know, it's a good way to start rather than haphazardly or quickly attacking what is perceived to be problems, right? I think having a framework to start is very important, and it really worked. At least for me, when I transitioned into that role. So using the self-assessment tool in Broadridge, the team was able to gauge where we're at, right? And it helped us doing the SWOT analysis. That's the origin for our 3-year strategic plan, right? It all started there because I really think you have to be organized when you are to transform an organization. It has to start from systematically. That to me was really very helpful at that time. And it's still very helpful today, honestly. We still use it today. Not that we're going to be applying for Baldrige Excellence, you know, no. But I think it's very, very helpful. Or having any other framework to start with, right? There's so many of them, right? But I was happy that we started there.
I was going to ask, Don and I had a conversation several weeks ago on the show, and we were talking about the Baldrige Award. And at the time, I didn't ask, but have there ever been any FQHCs that you're aware of that have gone after the Baldrige Award that you're aware of?
Google, I think there was one.
Okay.
If I remember when I was Googling it at that time.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think there is.
Well, we can Google that after the live stream is done. One of the things that I've learned about FQHCs is the board has a very unique composition. I wonder if you can speak to the composition of the board and how did you, given the fact that you hadn't been with the organization for very long, how much engagement did you get from the board as you were putting the Baldrige framework and bringing it into the organization?
So talking about the board composition, 51% of them, you know, HRSA, which is our main regulator, so to speak, of the FQHCs, mandates that at least 51% of them are patients of the community health center, right? And then some of the board have expertise, financial expertise, operational expertise. Some of them should represent, the main community, homeless, the representation of the migrants, right? Representation of the population that you actually serve. So those are some of the requirements for board leadership in a community health center. And going, to answer the question after that, I mean, I think when I transitioned into the role, the first thing I did really is to present to the board. The executive team convened. Again, using the framework, right? What are the challenges? What are the problems? What are those that are working for us, right? SWOT analysis, basically. And then laying that down by categories. These are the operational gaps that we're seeing, right? These are the where we're at financially. These are IT and cybersecurity issues we're facing. These are workforce development issues we're facing. And presenting that to the board and making them understand and see a clearer picture of where the organization is a good way to start to promote buy-in, right? They need to understand where the organization is, what is happening. And then you have to engage them, right? You present to them the problems. And then you have to paint them a picture of what are the steps you are planning to take alongside the board in tackling individual problems with clear expectations, with clear goals, right? So the next phase basically is strategic plan. And with that, you really have to engage the board. I think board training is also part of it. One of those priorities that we implemented is to make sure that the board understand the role, what is the board leadership role, what is the executive team role, right? Because I think at that time, that was also a main source of confusion. The board not fully understanding what their duties are and how it is separate from a chief executive officer duty. I think at some point there was sort of commingling or there was sort of overstepping, if I may use that word, that posed some challenges to the organization. So educating, looking for resources to educate the board, and then coming up with ways, how do we engage the board members, right? And, how do I make the board understand what are the challenges we're facing, right? And how we can work together. Now, the executive team, what the executive team can do, and then what the board needs to do. to promote these strategies and to accomplish key objectives that you are setting.
So Don put a comment in the chat that it was South Central Health System in Alaska. So thank you, Don, for putting that in.
There is one.
So we don't have to Google that anymore. We have our Google expert listening in the room meeting. So, well, a lot of interesting questions just come up to me. So you've gone through, you've been elevated to the CEO role. You've created this major change in the organization and introducing an entirely new framework to them about how you want them to look at the FQHC. So out of that process, what kind of KPIs or success measurements did you and the board settle on that would determine whether you were on the right trajectory after you went through all this process?
Question. So you do your strategic plan, right? You have main categories, you know, based on what we set. Okay, let's look at our operational gaps, operational problems, right? Or clinical problems, from no-shows to cancellations, for example, right? Or physician productivity and things like that. And then you set objectives, the KPIs around that, no-show reduction, cancellation reduction, optimizing provider productivity. And you have targets. If you're talking about financial metrics, then, you know, what is relevant to FKHG days cash on hand, right? You're talking about operating margin. You're talking about reimbursement KPIs, and AR, net AR collection, things like that are very important. Workforce, you're talking about employee satisfaction, retention rate, right? So that's how we lay those out. So for each main problem that we identified, right, we set a goal. We set an objective and a target, basically. And that's what KPI could best measure whether those change ideas that we are implementing are actually working or not. So it's not an individual effort. It was really truly a team effort, the executive team and the board, and coming up with all those KPIs that we actually track monthly, quarterly, and then annually. You know, when you do an annual strategic, that's how we, it starts with what are the objectives, right? And then what are the identifying KPIs that would best represent. And it has to be obviously measurable and trackable for us, right? Given the infrastructure that we have, the capabilities that we have.
Has your strategic plan changed significantly from the time since you joined the FQHC as a CMO and today?
So the strategic plan, we made this 3-year strategic plan, 23 to 25. Actually, I'm kind of looking at it. And I would say 80% of them have been achieved, 20% still a work in progress. I'm looking at the poster right now. We are really on track when it comes to the main paradigms in that strategic plan. And every quarter, every so often, you review your KPIs, you review your progress, and you just make tweaks, right? In those change ideas that you're trying to implement, right? Okay, this is not really moving in the right direction. What is going on, right? Do we have to change something or do we have to tweak the process that we're implementing, things like that. But so far, the strategic goals that we talked about and discussed when we did that strategic planning is still the same goals that we have. And I'm happy to say a lot of those we have accomplished, really. So now in this upcoming fiscal year, we're going to have to really discuss our next 3-year cycle strategic planning, based on the successes and the losses or those that are still that need to be met, right?
You mentioned that when you took over, the organization was pretty significantly in the red. Has the strategic plan helped to improve your financial situation as well?
Oh, yes. Let's put it this way. It starts operationally. You address a lot of operational issues. And we've more than doubled our visits. Our total active patients have increased, definitely. And our net assets have definitely more than doubled. If not, people can see the 990. Obviously, the last 990 you see there is when I moved. Hopefully, when the next 990 comes around. And, there's really significant improvement, operationally, financially, they go hand in hand, as you know, right?
Right. So it sounds like you do have the organization on a better footing. What do you see in the next, as you're thinking about the vision for the future, not just of Optum Health, but for all FQHCs, especially with the changing climate that we're under, with a focus on government spending, and trying to reduce waste. What do you see in the next 5 or 10 years for an FQHC organization?
It's really being the safety net provider that we are and the challenges that it comes with, like the reimbursement issues, grant funding issues, right? Sustainability is always one of those things that we always need to consider. Are we going to be here in the next 5 years, right? That's the immediate question all the time. And then what can we do to be, grant funding is a support. You know, I always tell my team, when I moved into the CEO role, one of the first things I did was to make everybody understand from front desks, medical assistants to even physicians and nurse practitioners, there's misconception among nonprofits, community health centers. Oh, we're grant funded, right? Money is coming out from a tree, right? Which is really, it's wrong, right? I mean, grant funding is but a small percentage of what makes you survive. At the end of the day, you have to make them understand that for us to survive and be sustainable, right, we have to see patients. Mm-hmm. We have to, just like any other practice, we have to bill insurances. We have to collect from those insurances. We have to collect from patients, because that is what makes the bulk of your revenue, right? And yes, not the other way around. You have to make them understand, because for a long time, a lot of people here thought it's the other way around, that seeing patient is just supporting grant funding, which is, you know, a very, very incorrect way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So I think, Jim, the first day, actually, that's what I did. I did sort of a town hall meeting and really discussed them where the organization was at that time, and then sort of educated them about FQHC. Not a lot of physicians, I would say majority of the providers at that time don't even know how we get reimbursed, right? So making them understand how we are reimbursed, what are the sources of revenue, and making them understand the challenges, right? So anyway, to answer your question, the next 5 years, the immediate vision I have is for us to be here still, right? And look for other sources of revenue outside of grant funding, which means beefing up the operations to make sure that we see optimal number of patients, that we increase total active patients, that we continue to increase the number of visits, and what are things internally that we can improve on to bring that on. So one of the things that we have done here is actually to bring in specialists, right? Because you have internal referrals from your pool of primary care providers. Now you hand them off to the specialists. Know that not only is it a good, patients are satisfied because you need a cardiologist, you see our internal cardiologist, right? You need an endocrinologist, you have an internal endocrinologist to see, right? And then they also generate visits, right? So, and that's how it is. One patient, you generate multiple visits, you get paid PPS rate, right? I think the next thing that is unique to FQHC is the concept of satellite clinics, what we call intermittent clinics, as you know, right? So you have licensed clinics and then intermittent clinics. And these are one of those things that we analyzed here. So what is that? Intermittent clinic is a clinic that is operating, but its license is tied to your main licensed clinic. And why is this important? Because multiple licensed clinics have different PPS rates, right? You may have one clinic that sees a lot of patients, you have multiple specialties in there, and then you have a cost reporting, right? An annual cost report. And then based on that cost report, the HRSA would determine your PPS rate. How much do I pay for every visit you generate for that center, right? And then when we did an analysis, right, we saw that, we have one center that is, on the high side, but 80% of our locations are probably just half of that, right? And this is where you think about, do we need to convert some of our licensed clinic to intermittent clinics? Because the advantage of that is you de-license a clinic that has a very low PPS rate, convert it to an intermittent clinic tied to your highest PPS rate. So in the short term, you are generating revenue without having to change the volume of patients you're seeing for that clinic, right? So things like that, taking advantage of programs like that or characteristics like that, that's unique to us, right, is important. So we did a lot of those. We, de-licensed some of our clinics and tied them to our highest licensed clinics, and helped us, obviously, financially. right? Apart from all the changes you did to make sure that you increase your total active patients, and apart from operational changes you did to make sure that patients are following up and you generate more visits.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So you mentioned at the very beginning, you're talking about visits again. This is a very underserved population, and oftentimes medication adherence, following up with visits is exceptionally challenging in this population. What were the most successful strategies that you employed to try to reverse the high no-show rate, the cancellation rate, and just providing better patient care and access to patients?
During your identifying problems, right, from check-in to check-out and ancillary, the call center, for example, how our schedule is made, what are the provider schedule templates, right? What is our policies, policies and procedures when it comes to no-shows and cancellations, right? Or who is in charge of making sure that patients actually confirm for their appointments? And what do we do to make sure that the patients who don't confirm appointments, what would be our next steps, right? So those are problems that we identified, and we come up with some change ideas surrounding those. It's an ongoing quality improvement project, as you know. No-show is always going to be a challenge, especially in this patient population. So first, we looked at the provider schedule, right? Is our provider schedule, the way that it was templated, really making it accessible for our patients when they call the same day, for example, or they have an urgent visit, right? Is the schedule allowing them access to our providers or not? So we had to make, along with our providers, clinical operations director, so we made some changes to those templates, having same day appointment slots, for example, things like that. Or what is our process? If the patient's PCP is fully booked, then how do we schedule this patient? Make sure that there is an access for this patient. And then confirmation, right? Second step, what is our way? What process do we have in place to allow the patient to confirm their appointments without having to call, right? So this is making use of technology, obviously, making full use of the features your electronic medical record allows you to do, whether it's text confirmation or confirmation through robocalls, right? But at the other end, right, who's actually tracking those, right? Yeah, patients are always confirming, but nobody's tracking whether the patient confirmed or not, right? So that we can target those who haven't confirmed yet and what to do with those who haven't confirmed, right? So having a workflow in place to make sure that those who have not confirmed through text or calls, who's going to be in charge of reaching out to these individuals? And if that third layer, there's still no confirmation from the patient, what do we do then? Do we just replace this from a pool and a wait list patients? But what if the patient shows up? Then that would be, there's a process to that as well, right? So those are some of the processes that we implemented. And then technology is always, and nowadays, there's so many tools that you can use to make sure that your process can be streamlined, right? AI is here, for example. Right. And one of the AI feature that it's an ongoing quality improvement we have, it's called electronic record, is called eClinical Works. And last year they came out with an AI feature. It's called AI no-show. And what it does is it predicts the no-show probability of a patient.
Okay.
You put a patient in a schedule, it's going to tell you based on a factor, data, both internal data and external data, as long as there is information from the electronic health exchange, for those in Epic Care Link, right? I mean, those external health records, right? So it calculates a probability, hey, this patient has 90% probability of not showing up for an appointment. So in our quality improvement project, we came up with a decision tree that call centers will use in how to decide what to do with a patient who has greater than so-and-so probability of no-show. And so it's an ongoing project. We're probably in our fourth cycle at this time, still a lot of tweaking. Seems very promising. For primary care, now each specialty is different because each specialty, the schedule, you know, the way you schedule things are different, right? So right now we're focusing, that quality is focusing on primary care, and we've made several tweaks. So far, preliminary data has shown that from a 30% no-show, I believe the last data, we've cut it to around 15% no-show. Wow. For our patient.
So yeah, obviously
just the use of that and the AI tool and a decision tree based on that probability. So in other words, quality improvement, right? Technology, quality improvement is very important. I think that's one of the key strategies when I step into the role is instilling the culture of quality improvement actually in the organization, which was, I would say, really pretty much non-existent at that time. In a small organization, sometimes that gets overlooked, right? We don't need that. Let's just run things. But having a good quality improvement team in place and process in place and instilling this culture of being proactive rather than reactive is very important.
I was going to say that you must have a great quality team. You obviously can't see this kind of improvement without the right team. What have you done? What kind of a team do you have focused on this? I assume that you're, because of your reference to Baldrige, that you're kind of using sort of a lean management approach but maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
First thing is, you know, who will make up the quality improvement team? We started with that. Who is your QI committee, so to speak, you know, from the medical, the medical director, CEO, clinical directors, supervisors, right? So we identify those people and we invested. You know, we enrolled them to IHI. They did certification, IHI certification ongoing, and they're always encouraged if there's anything, within the IHI learning that you're interested to learn, right? And then obviously Don in the first part only, but had a good data analyst. We're fortunate that we were able to find an exceptional data analyst. We have a clinical director who's very invested in quality improvement. There's not a whole ton of people out there. By that, I mean, we opened positions for quality improvement positions, and there's not a whole traction, seems like, at least here in San Diego, is like, where are these people who are interested with quality improvement, right? So anyway, short of having those people, it's really investing in identifying people who are interested within the organization and then making sure that they have, you support them, you invest in them, having resources available. Currently, we really use IHI. We did consulting. There's lots of consulting available for FQHEs or healthcare industry in general. We used one called Whipley, and we did some consulting. They talked about quality improvement, things like that. We did huge quality improvement among our dental department, and that also meant engaging experienced consultants to assist us in designing those quality improvement, right? Identifying problems and coming up with brainstorming on solutions or change ideas, right? So external help is always very, you have to look outside to help you navigate through these things, and investing in those, I think that's key. Investing internally in people, identifying people who you think, are interested or who are vocal about their interest, right? And nurturing that and providing them with resources. And then identifying external support and investing in those externals. The culture of quality improvement, it's one of the hardest, in my opinion, that's one of the hardest thing in terms of, when we were implementing a lot of changes here in this organization. People in a community health center, and then you have aging workforce, right, that not all of them are going to be open. How it is, in the MBA, you always hear, with quality, there's going to be the early adopters, there's going to be those laggers, right, there's always going to be those resisting, right? And, there's, I would say majority of them were resisting at that time, but I think that when you show them, right, I think this is where, when you show them data, Right? When you show them how things are changing, not just, you know, look at our patient volume, look at our patient satisfaction, look at our financial metrics, right? And when they see that, you will promote more buy-in, honestly.
I think that's a great story. And I think I so agree with everything that you've said and what you've done, the investment in staff and building a team. It sounds like you pretty much had to build a team from the ground up. You mentioned earlier as well that you were losing patient volume. How have you taken all of this work and made it visible to the public? How do they know that coming to Optum Health is now a really great option for them?
First, having, you know, when we're doing the SWOT analysis, right? So it starts with first identifying your mission. We have to change our mission vision, honestly. It all starts with that, right? What is really our mission, right? And you know, at that time, God, I can't remember the mission anymore. The mission at that time was, it's so vague. Is this really the mission that we're trying to achieve, right? So anyway, we revamped our mission. We make sure we have clear vision in place, right? And then we look at our name, no? For it's called Operation Samahan, and at that time it's called Samahan Health Centers. So one of the things we did, and we felt like at that time, was let's start with perhaps rebranding, so to speak. And there's a reason for that. Samahan is a Filipino word. It means working together or working collaboratively. It's a good, positive word. Right? But when we're doing our analysis, you know, in the surveys, patient surveys, you know, or those who are not patients of Samahan yet, right? One of the things that always come up is, oh, Samahan, we thought that's only for Filipinos. So at that time, we felt like, you know what? It became double-edged. It was a good word. It did attract Filipinos to come to your office, but it did not really promote diversity in terms of catering to other patients, right? And there's a whole ton of them. Now, there's a lot of underserved individuals. But if non-Filipinos feel like they can't go to your organization, then you're not really fulfilling your mission of being a safety net provider, right? So that's why we changed the name to Opsam Help. Opsam, remaining true to its legal entity name, Operation Samahan Opsam Health. And we felt like this will be more welcoming, right? Now, you still remain true to your origin, but at the same time, it will hope in the hope that it will promote engagement from patients in the community and not having and eliminate that misconception that we're only for Filipinos. But also getting the word out there, right? And there are several ways, from flyers to engaging, radios, you know, stations, or engaging. Luckily, we have a Filipino newscaster in here. And, you know, we engaged her, right? And getting the mission out there, right? And telling everyone that we're here and we're here to cater to everyone, right? Regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, right? We're here, we're new, we're Opsam Health, we're called Opsam Health, and you're welcome to come to our door. But that also comes with making sure that people in your clinic or your workforce also are able to cater to that cultural need or linguistic need, right? Hence, you know, when we talking about workforce strategy, when it comes to workforce development, promoting diversity, and then not just promoting diversity, right? It really has to align with your population, the population that you serve, right? So talking about making sure that you hire bilingual staff as much as possible, bilingual Spanish, bilingual Tagalog, being the two major race that, you know, that make up our population of patients, to your medical assistants, right, to your providers. So that's how we are able to attract, you know, successfully non-patients or to join us. But talking about patients, now, how do you encourage patients to come back? Those who have been disillusioned, right? And those who were once dissatisfied, right? And for us, you know, no matter, you know, if somebody has a bad experience, if you just tell them, oh, we have changed, now, without them actually visibly and palpably seeing and feeling that there's actually change, they're not going to come back, right? So, you know, those operational changes that we did, from streamlining check-in, or to making, you know, to check-in to check-out, right? Again, accessibility, call center issues, for example, right? Call center, you know, is always a struggle. It's always one of the major sources of dissatisfaction. So we did a whole ton of quality improvement. We changed how we do the call center here at OPSAM to make it easier for patients to get to their appointments or, you know, address their issues and things like that. And then, you know, patients started to see those changes. And you know how it is in clinical practice. It's word of mouth as well, right? They have some of their friends and relatives still with us. You know what? There's a lot of changes there. Why don't you come back, right? And luckily, if there's one thing about Filipinos and you know, Hispanics is, let's talk about the Filipinos. Being the Catholic, I always joke this, you know, being the Catholic that they're very forgiving. If they were able to re-elect a dictator as a president, they will be able to forgive OPSAM. But it's just kidding aside, but let's put politics out of the... And true enough, no, a lot of them came back, right? But there are also those other low-hanging fruits, right? Low-hanging fruits that would make sure that you are able to schedule this, reach out to these patients, right? Let's talk about the care gaps. Full use of data that your health plans are giving you on a monthly basis, right? You have monthly list of care gaps, and you see hundreds and hundreds of patients that are not coming in for their breast cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening, right? And when you reach out to them, some of them simply don't feel like they have to come into the office. You encourage them. Some of them might have transferred to other clinics out of dissatisfaction from previous experiences, and then you encourage them to come back, right? And the next is a pool of what we call capitated lives, right? Your health plans assign thousands of lives to you. And guess what? Less than 10% of that actually call to establish care. You have 90% of these capitated lives that are already your patients. Either they don't bother to call because they're young and they feel healthy, they feel like they don't need annual, right? Or some of them just don't, I just have this insurance. No, I didn't even know I was assigned to you, right? And I don't feel anything, right? So one of the things that we're doing is actually we opened a position that would purely be responsible for reaching out to this list of patients, what we call attributed lives, right? They're assigned but not yet established. So their main responsibility was just to reach out to this and promote the services and get them into our door, right? So there are many ways. There are many ways that we can do to increase that lives. And then there are several other programs. Now, I don't know if you in your there in Great Lakes, you have enhanced care management as well, but here in California, it's a big thing, CalAIMS, what we call the ECM program, right? Yeah. Enhanced care management program. And, you know, these are for those with, you know, positive, you know, a lot of social determinants of health, multiple comorbidities in and out the hospital, right? Or those coming from incarceration, things like that. So there's a lot of criteria for them to be eligible for this program, right? So we have an excellent team here who's doing our ECM program out and about in the community, partnering with skilled nursing facilities, partnering with case managers in the hospitals, right? And, you know, you're able to get a lot of patients from those, right? You enroll them into the ECM program, and at the same time, you're able to get them into your door, you know, to establish primary care. Or some of them might be established with other community health centers already, but guess what? They need chiropractic service. They need dental service. They need women's service, right? And, you know, you offer it to them, hey, we have those specialties here. You can come to our office without having to change your primary care provider, right? So explaining to them those things.
This has been a great conversation. And I know we're getting near the top of the hour. I still have a couple of areas I'd like to pivot into, if you don't mind. But thank you for taking the time to share all of your insights. And it sounds like you've become an expert juggler with all the balls that you have to keep in the air all the time.
So that, to learn, still a lot to learn, but I'm trying my best. Yes.
How long have you been in the role, by the way? I never asked you how long you've been the CEO.
Going on third year this May.
Okay. From the number of patients that you have or the number of visits that you have annually, how large is OPSAM Health right now?
From say less than 30 plus thousand visits to the last UDS report for the calendar year 2024, we have close to 70,000
wow.
visits. From less than 11,000 total active patients to 13,600 active patients.
Okay.
So that's where we're at currently. Great.
Thank you. I should have asked that earlier. I want to ask you, when you took your MBA, and you mentioned you were at Bakersfield when you enrolled in Pemba.
I was in Palm Springs already.
What's that?
I was in Palm Springs already at that time.
Okay. Was this the trajectory that you thought the MBA would put you on, or did you have a different vision, a different reason for getting the MBA at that time?
Never in my dream. I was like, I want to be a CEO. No. I mean, at that time, I was an internist in Palm Springs. That was the time I came from an FKHE lookalike. Mm-hmm. My exposure to FKHE lookalike, I was sort of a very young, the SIBS medical director at that time. And there are so many things there. And also my private practice, right? And I felt like at that time, I was so ill-equipped, right? I was assigned as a medical director in this FKHE lookalike. CEO invited me, I need you to attend this board meeting. It was like, it's my first board meeting, right? What do I do here, right? And they handed me this financial statements, like, I don't know how to read this financial statements, right? Things like that. And you have an idea of quality improvement, right? But it's not something that I was experienced at that time. There's so many challenges that I identified at that time, but how do I go about these challenges? Even in my private practice, right? How do I do this? How do I do that, right? At that time, I said, I think let me look into, maybe an MBA program. Maybe it will help me. Maybe it won't, right? So I was looking at several MBA programs, and then I moved to Palm Springs. Yeah, I was happy with my practice and kind of forgot about it. And then on my second year, I said, let me revisit this. Maybe it's time to, I'm already there. I'm already stable there. So I have more time. I have saved up, I guess, because, MBA is very expensive. Let's put it that way. Okay, let me go into this. I enrolled without having really a clear, honestly, without having a clear objective. Like, I'm going to use this because I want to be this. Really is like at that time, I was like, I really want to gain more insight, how to and see, learn tools that would help me perhaps navigate as I go through if I were to explore leadership opportunities in the future.
Okay. So do you think that in the long run, would you say that money that you invested and probably more importantly or as importantly, the time you invested has paid off for you? Would you do it again?
I will. It really equips you with a lot of things, right? From not just reading financial statements or learning about lean process, right? Or about, it just gives you an overall different view of how to see things from a leadership perspective, right? One of the questions here when I was looking at this is, the biggest challenges from transitioning from a clinical role to a leadership role. And I think that's one of those, how do I change my mindset? Because as a clinician, we have different agenda, mm-hmm. right? And that is just taking care of our patients alongside work-life balance. Work-life balance is a big phrase nowadays, as you know, right? And then how do I transition from that thinking to now a leadership thinking wherein you have to worry about sustainability? And how do you find that balance, right? That to me at first was really a struggle, but I think this is where tools that you learn in MBA really help you. Help you navigate through those transitions, help you making sure that you have ideas how to navigate things, right? Like the Baldridge, mm-hmm. for example. I always go back to that. To me, it was the biggest tool I was able to use, honestly, along with reading and understanding financial statements, obviously. But to me, it was one of those key things. It was really, honestly, not saying it because Don is here, but it really started there. It really started there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that was certainly one of the most valuable things that you took away from the program. I wonder if you could share, not so much content-wise, but all of us have different memories of the Pemba program. I wonder if you would mind sharing what your favorite memory of Pemba is, really stands out.
That was my biggest memory. After my first, I was only able to go to UT campus once. And then week after that, went home. Week after that, pandemic happened.
Yeah.
That's the most memorable. Pandemic happened. Everything was online.
Yeah. Yeah, that was quite a change for everybody to have not have the residency periods. And
I think overall, it's, having, you have so many accomplished physicians who are your classmates, right? And some of them are CEOs already. Some of them are in the C-suite. Some of them are like me at that time. It was just a clinician navigating our way, right? And you come to talk to them and look at perspectives, right? Oh, why are you doing this? Why are you going to MBA? How does this help you, right? And then I think that to me is one of those biggest things that you can have experience-wise, just by being able to immerse yourself with a group of intelligent people with each objective. You know, individually, they have their own objectives and they have their own thinking of how they're going to be using their learning, you know, from MBA, an MBA program.
Great. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Bella. We've kind of run out of our time, and thank everybody who joined us. We will be releasing this episode as a podcast in a few weeks, so we will put that out onto our YouTube channel as well. So we're happy that you were able to join us today for our PEMA On Demand live stream. We have these live streams monthly, as you know, discussing topics relevant to you as physician leaders. I'd like to thank Kate Atchley, Don Leiter, and Tom Brown for their support. I couldn't do this without their support. We also, as I mentioned earlier, do release bi-monthly podcasts every other Thursday. There will be a podcast released this Thursday on the 20th with Dr. Chris Chisholm, or with Zach Buck, who is an attorney from the University of Tennessee. So tune into that podcast. And please subscribe to the podcast channel if you haven't already had the opportunity to do that. The podcasts are available on Apple Podcasts, Castos, Overcast, Pandora, and Spotify. You can also see them at our YouTube channel, which is www.youtube.com/@PEMBAON-demand with no spaces. CME is also available for this live stream. Don't forget to visit our website to obtain your CME certificate. Again, thank you for joining, and I will see you next month. I hope you enjoyed this episode of PEMBA On Demand, taken from our March 18th live stream with Dr. Archie Bella. I'm always fascinated and intrigued by the opportunities presented to us during our careers and the professional journeys that result. Thank you very much for joining us today. PEMBA On Demand is released bi-weekly every other Thursday and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PEMBAON-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PEMBAONDEMAND, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.